A podcast of the cinema.
You are Alonzo Duralde. You are the film reviews editor for The Wrap. Also, you are the host, co-host, rather, of What the Flick on the Young Turks Network. And also, you are the co-host of Who Shot Ya on the Maximum Fun Network.
And you are Dave Weitz, film critic for The Wrap and the hardest working man in show business.
You should turn it down just a little bit for me today.
One of the 10 hardest working men in show business. Or did you mean my actual volume?
No, I meant just the whole enthusiasm for life thing.
Sorry.
So I sure am glad that we went to see Mamma Mia on Friday and got that rollicking episode where we spent 1 hour doing nothing but
discussing Mamma Mia,
enjoying that experience. Because once Saturday hit, everything turned to hell. I woke up with a sore throat, which is not the problem. That's all gone by now. That was just an allergy sinus zonk out situation. But Jonathan Gold is dead.
Yes.
You texted me. No, you
called
me. You didn't text me. You called me Saturday night from Outfest to tell me about this. And I've had, experience with this in the past year with friends calling me to tell me that another friend is dead. And that happened last November. And it's weird because I don't know how y'all do things. Y'all, I mean y'all, the listeners. But life becomes a fog. I feel like I'm walking underwater when this happens. And this has been the way I've reacted to the death of friends and family my whole life. I have this sort of delayed reaction, like I go numb.
It's like when your ears won't pop,
something like that.
You're in this sort of vacuum. I know that.
Perhaps yes. We have known Jonathan for about, well, how long have Robert and Margie been married? 17, 18 years now.
Yeah, something like that.
I met him the first time at Robert and Margie's wedding shower, because that wedding shower was here in this apartment.
Right.
And he and Robert and Margie and they've been tight for forever.
Yeah.
And I just remember, like, I didn't really know anything about him. Like, I hadn't gone out of my way to read his work. I hadn't, no one had pointed me to it. And if they had, I don't know if I was paying attention or not, but
this would have been, he was still at the LA Weekly back then.
This was back at the LA Weekly, back when Manolo wrote for the LA Weekly and he wrote for the LA Weekly and Laurie was an editor at the LA Weekly back when the LA Weekly was the LA Weekly.
Right. Not the sham that
it's a sham.
Yeah.
I remember knowing that he was a food writer. But he walked in and he saw a record that I had near the turntable by a very weird little band that was based in Los Angeles, called the Polar Goldie Cats. Instrumental, band of just weird music, Captain Beefheart kind of sounding stuff. And he immediately picked it up and he said, "Oh, I really like these guys. I know this person, blah, 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 blah." And that, I almost never talked to Jonathan about food. Like, except on Facebook, I did, because I would start mentioning a recipe that I was working on, and all these people would chime in with advice, and he'd go, "No, do this, don't do that. Use this ingredient, not that ingredient." Like, he always had quick advice that was definitive. And when I would see him, when I would see him, it was usually in a food context, or a Lori context, because Lori was my editor at the LA Weekly, and she
Jonathan's
was
wife.
Jonathan's wife, Lori Ochoa. She is an editor at the Los Angeles Times, but back then she was the editor, one of the editors of the LA Weekly. She was my editor there. She was also my editor at a literary magazine called Slake.
I did not realize until that piece that Margie sent us recently about Gourmet Magazine that Lori was an editor there under Ruth Reichel.
I knew she was connected to Gourmet, but I didn't know what her official, thing
She's
was.
also an editor of The Hollywood Reporter. Like, she's had
Yes.
a,
No, I know. But I knew about the Hollywood
No,
Reporter.
I know. I'm just for the listeners.
Anyway, there was it was either something regarding something that I'd written for Lori, or a food thing, a party, a restaurant where there was a bunch of people. And yet, in spite of those like Facebook interactions where he would say, "Okay, this is how you make the best beef stew," we never talked about food. We talked about music. When I would see him out with friends, if we were talking about something, it would be something about music. Like, I always had some dumb band shirt on, and he would start talking about that band because he knew everything.
I remember seeing him at Sundance when City of
City of
Gold
Gold.
premiered. And it was just this random thing where he was clearly running around doing a million things, but I just caught this 20 minutes of downtime that he and the director had between things. So I was just kind of sitting with them, and we just sort of swapped, isn't Sundance crazy stories.
They came to our wedding at the Tar Pits.
Yes.
He was a major dude, and I am so sad right now. And I don't, there's no, the only way to deal with this kind of thing for me is just like work, be busy. Anyway, you should see City of Gold. If you don't know who he was, you should see City of Gold, because it's lovely. And it's,
And read him.
yeah, there's a lot on the internet by him that you can read. I'll tell you one of my favorite things that he ever wrote. I know this is weird, but like when the first issue of Slake came out, I had that goofy piece in there about being a production assistant on a gay porn set, which did in fact happen to me in the year 2003 in the San Fernando Valley in December in Los Angeles. He wrote an article about a still life of food at the Norton Simon. And it was the coolest piece. Slake magazine, issue number one. You know, it's still available. You can still buy it. Anyway, we'll talk more about him on Linoleum Knife and Fork.
Yes.
But I don't want to go on. I have all these ideas and things in my head. I don't want to just go on and on and on about this. I feel so bad right now for Lori.
I know.
And
their kids.
And the kids, yeah. This is so awful. He had pancreatic cancer, and they didn't know it until 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. He was 57.
Yeah. I'm 54.
No, I'm 51.
Okay, let's talk about movies. I don't want to talk about more things like this.
Okay.
All right. You saw two that I haven't seen. One of them I'm not going to see, and one of them I am going to see.
Okay.
Because this week, the temperature's going to be up in the mid-90s again, and I'm going to run off to movie theaters and escape. Can you please talk about those? I'm going to sip water.
Could you tell me what we're talking about?
Oh, would you like me to read you from the order of show?
Yes. You have a run of show that I've never seen, so...
Hotel Transylvania 3, colon, something. Oh, Summer by vacation. By the way... Regarding colons,
There's not a colon.
We made a mistake.
Mamma Mia, here we go again. But there is an exclamation point.
There is an exclamation point. There's not a colon. We said there was an exclamation point and then a colon.
Yeah.
Which, in our defense, would have been appropriately ESL mistakishness.
In an ABBA sort of
in
way.
In an ABBA sort of way.
We knew there wasn't a two in it.
Because in Mamma Mia, exclamation point, here we go again. As we discussed in the first, in the full-length Mamma Mia Linoleum Knife episode.
The epic discussion.
The film opens with them singing When I Kissed the Teacher.
Mm.
There's a lyric in that song. Where they actually, the original version of the song, you can hear, you know, the ladies singing the lyrics. I was in the seventh heaven when I kissed the teacher. Which is not exactly
the
way people say that. But if you're Swedish and it's 1972... And you're starting to write songs that are not in Swedish.
Yeah.
It's fine.
If you're a Eurovision champ.
But you would think that for a film that takes liberties with original lyrics these songs, that they might maybe correct the English.
Oh, wait, they left? I was in this.
Yes. they leave it like that.
Well, I mean, it does fill out the line, you know.
You know what? Who cares if it fills out the line?
Well, you know, you got to have that pentameter and all.
Sure.
Okay, so...
There was another thing that we missed in discussing Mamma Mia. Here we go again.
Oh, yes. You brought
blogging.
Up... yes, you asked if there was an internet in the movie, and I said there were smartphones. I forgot that among the guests at the grand opening of the hotel was a blogger.
A blogger that they were counting on to write about the hotel and put them on the map.
Uh-huh.
Like, okay.
It's like those Hallmark Channel movies.
That's like saying I was in the seventh heaven.
When they talk about bloggers or, you know, Instagram. Like, you can tell, like, somebody knew they had to mention these things in the plot,
right.
But they have no idea what it means. Or they vastly overestimate, like, what going viral means.
The influence of these things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, someone has a travel blog and they write about your hotel in Greece. And what? And then what?
Bam.
What happens then? Like, does Madonna book a room the next week? No. The script, they could have easily said, oh yeah, Condé Nast Traveler.
Exactly.
Or does that exist anymore? I don't know if it exists anymore.
Maybe.
Vanity Fair.
Travel and Leisure.
Yeah. Vanity Fair. Town and Country. Who, like, some fancy, fancy magazine.
Right. Horses and Hounds.
Is here. Is that a still?
I don't know.
Is that a thing?
I think that was a joke in Notting Hill. Isn't that the magazine Hugh Grant pretends to be from?
Oh, I don't know.
But there is Gun and Garden or whatever.
I guess.
No, a blogger.
Yeah. Like, would you have to pay Vanity Fair to use the name Vanity Fair in a sentence?
No.
No, right? You wouldn't have to do that.
They're a public enterprise.
It's just a strange... That's such a weird little... That's, like I said, it's the equivalent of saying I was in the Seventh Heaven. Yeah.
All right, so...
Hotel Transylvania 3.
And that's the one you're not going to see?
I'm not going to see that.
Okay, fine.
I enjoyed the first two Hotel Transylvania films just because I was there, and it was funny. And our friend Rose was a voice of one of the creatures, or more than one of the creatures.
Right.
Is she a voice in this one?
I didn't look.
I'm going to look right now while you talk about Hotel Transylvania 3. If she is, I might consider going. Or at least watching it on cable when it shows up there.
I had a lovely time. Admittedly, I was sitting next to Bibbs, who makes any movie...
A pleasure.
A little better than it would be, just because his level of enjoyment. Like... There's actually a point where somebody makes this lame pun about, you know, the mummy's not the only one in denial. And Bibbs howled laughing at that. I'm like, and that was the one time I actually turned to him and I went, seriously, that joke? Anyway, it's...
Listen, were you at the screening of Premium Rush?
No, I know he loves that one, though.
Bibbs went, like...
But I saw White House Down with him.
Full ham at that screening.
I sat between, I had Bibbs and Whitney on one side of me and Gray Drake on the other side of me at White House Down, and we just had a rollicking good time. Anyway, Hotel Transylvania 3, if you like the first two, you'll like this one too. It's the same.
Rose is not a voice in this one.
Ah, boo. It's the same.
And that's why I'm not going.
Fine. It's the same shtick, different day, but... basically, Dracula, voiced by Adam Sandler, and his daughter, who is Selena Gomez, Mavis, you know, they work together at the hotel, but hospitality is a very demanding business, and
Right. They
just don't see a lot of each other. So they decide, she decides after seeing an ad on TV for this cruise, they're going to all go on a cruise. So their family, the Wolfman, the Frankensteins, the mummies, everybody, the Invisible Man, they all go on this cruise. And it's even pointed out that, so wait, we're leaving one hotel to go to essentially another hotel. But this one is a cruise that starts at the Bermuda Triangle and ends at Atlantis. And it seems to be almost always nighttime, and no one ever comments on that fact. The captain of the ship, who's voiced by Catherine Hahn, it turns out, is the granddaughter or great-granddaughter of Van Helsing. And so this has all been an elaborate scheme for her to kill Dracula. But of course, it turns out they have feelings for each other and have to figure that out. It's, you know, it is, you know exactly what you're getting. But it is constantly inventive, both visually and with the jokes. It's Genndy Tartakovsky again directing the Dexter's Laboratory Samurai Jack guy. And yeah, I had a very good time. I laughed consistently. I liked looking at it. There's some really great visual gags involving the blob in this one. Yeah, it was perfectly fine.
Do you remember when we were children?
No.
And the Bermuda Triangle was really important.
Oh yeah, it was hot, hot, hot.
Like it was going to be a big, like it was a big thing.
I sat through an unbearable documentary about it as a kid.
People would talk about, was it In Search of the Bermuda Triangle?
Probably, something akin to that. It was one of those...
Airport 1977, reason they went, the reason they crashed was because they were through the Bermuda Triangle. And it made you, as a child, you're paying attention to all of this, like, trendy discussion about the Bermuda Triangle. Because it was a big thing in the 1970s.
Oh, yeah.
People would talk about it, like... A lot. Remember how you would think when you were a kid, like, well, this is a life lesson. I'm going to have to steer clear of this Bermuda Triangle. When I become an adult, I'm going to have to make sure I don't go near it. I won't get on a plane if I know what's going to, like, I'm going to make sure, like, I won't be on a boat or a plane that goes near the Bermuda Triangle. Like, they made it sound like it was going to be a much bigger consideration in our adult lives Like, we were going to have to think about it for the rest of our lives and steer clear, avoid it.
Well, in the movie, it's like...
It's going to figure into a lot of national,
It's like this literal triangle in the middle of the ocean where, like, water is running down the sides of it, and there's all these sunken ships.
I never knew... No one could ever explain to me why the Bermuda Triangle swallowed boats and planes.
I think it just had good PR.
Who acts as the publicist for the Bermuda Triangle, though? Not Bermuda. They don't want you associating them
the Hawaii Tourism Board, maybe.
It just seemed weird.
Yeah.
I just really believed that it was going to, be more of a thing in my grown-up life.
There was a lot of stupid stuff we spent a lot of time talking about in the 70s. UFOs.
Bigfoot was going to be a thing.
You know,
Bigfoot is kind of still a thing, I guess.
Remember pyramids? Remember how that was a whole thing? The pyramid power thing?
No. That I don't remember.
That was like a precursor to crystals.
Bisexuality was going to be a bigger thing than it is.
Yeah, what happened to Quaaludes?
It's still a big deal. I mean, especially if you're bisexual, but like in the 70s, the way people talked, they'd be like, well, no, everyone is. Everyone's bisexual. And then all these people were like, not real. I'm not really.
Thank God
for bisexuals. Proudly part of our LGBT community.
That's right. Give it up from a bees.
All right. You also saw Skyscraper.
Yes.
My plan is to go see Skyscraper during a hot day this week.
That's a very good idea.
I'm gonna go to the Grove.
It is an air conditioning delivery system, that movie.
I'm gonna go to the Grove and I'm gonna use up the last of my gift card at La Duree. I'm gonna go see Skyscraper. Then I'm probably gonna get some food at Cheesecake Factory. They have good air conditioning.
They do have good air conditioning
in Cheesecake Factory, and they are literally right next to the movie theater.
Yes. There needs to be a door.
And I don't care what anyone says about the Cheesecake Factory.
There needs to be a door where you could go from the theater to the Cheesecake Factory without actually having to go outside.
Right, right.
They, that really needs to happen. Have you had the cheeseburger spring rolls?
Yes. We ordered them one time together. Yes, you and yes, I. They were delicious.
I am a fan.
I mean, it's wrong.
Oh, thoroughly.
They shouldn't exist, I guess, technically.
They are an abomination against man and nature, but I think they're delicious. Okay.
Please talk to me about this movie that apparently is tanking.
It is tanking.
Why?
Well, I'll tell you. You know, everybody complains about how sequels and retreads and reboots and don't want them. I can't believe they're remaking my favorite. This past weekend, of the top 10, 8 of them were sequels or prequels. Because it was like Equalizer 2, Mamma Mia 2, Incredibles 2, Ant-Man and the Wasp, First Purge, Jurassic World, all these sequels. So, not that Skyscraper is aflame with originality. It is basically the Towering Inferno meets Die Hard in Asia with a prosthetic leg, you know.
Yeah.
But it's crazily entertaining, even though it's rock stupid. The Rock, stupid, I suppose. So Dwayne Johnson plays a former FBI agent at the beginning of the movie. He's involved in this hostage crisis that goes very wrong, and there's an explosion. He winds up losing most of one leg. The surgeon who fixes him up and gives him his prosthetic is played by Neve Campbell. Cut to 10 years later, they're married, they have 2 kids. He has a sort of struggling or an up-and-coming security business, and he's interviewing for a job at this enormous new skyscraper in Hong Kong that is 3 times as high as the Empire State Building. And an old Army or FBI buddy of his is like kind of hooking him up with the gig. And then There's this like keypad that only he has, but then they steal from him because these guys want to ruin the building and get this thing out of the safe. And so they set fire to one of the floors, but of course the Rock's family is there, but they're not supposed to be there, but they are. And what's going to happen? And he gets blamed for stuff, so he's got to elude the cops and get back into the building on the 100 and whatever floor by jumping them from a crane and then get them out of the building in one piece. It's real fun.
I want to see it because when I was a child, I really loved The Towering Inferno. Mm. I went back to see The Towering Inferno 4 times.
Wow.
In the theater. Well, there's a reason. It was basically the Poseidon Adventure in a building with fire.
Right.
The Poseidon Adventure was my favorite movie as a kid. The other reason was...
It's also one of your favorites as an adult.
It's also one of my favorites as an adult. But The Towering Inferno was great because it was extra long. Nothing made me happier as a child than to be able to leave my home for the entire afternoon on a weekend to see a movie or a double feature. Mm. Back in the day, double features were not my enemy, they were my friend. Ah. But here was this movie that was like pushing 3 hours. Just nonstop thrills and excitement. And I had this weird, can you call it a fetish?
I don't know how this sentence ends, I don't know.
At age 10, 11, can you call it a fetish? The Towering Inferno was released in the winter. Mm-hmm. It was released at Christmas time. I had this weird fetish for... going to a weekend matinee alone, as always, alone. Didn't like going with other kids. They were stupid. And then when I would get out of the theater, it would be dark. Go in when it's daytime, come out and it's nighttime. Every time that happened, I just felt this thrill of, you know, I've been hiding. I've been hiding for so long that it's a whole different, like, the sun went away. It extinguished itself. And I just felt like I was really cool. Why did I feel that way? I don't know. But I have always been, from childhood till even now when it happens, I think, ooh, it's nighttime now.
I'm a fan of standard time.
Yeah.
I like that sun goes down at 5:30, fine by me.
Well, this was in New England because I was a little kid in New England.
Yeah.
And that got dark at 4 o'clock in the afternoon during the winter months. Then, yeah.
Like, if I wanted to pinpoint one of my sort of memories that are why I love winter and why I love, like, Christmas time so much, I distinctly remember being in, like, seventh or eighth grade. I was on the swim team. It was an indoor pool. It was heated and everything. But then I remember, like, waiting for my mom to pick me up outside, and it would be cold, like cold for Atlanta, still cold,
yeah,
and dark, and my hair would be wet, and so it would just sort of, like,
freezing,
extra cold. But there was just something so bracing about the whole thing. I totally get it.
So, so I'm going to this.
Okay.
I will be at Skyscraper.
There's been some interesting discussion around the notion of The Rock playing an amputee. Kristen Lopez, who is a disabled film critic, wrote extensively about how much she loved the movie and how much she loved the fact that we had an action hero who not only has a prosthetic limb, but the prosthetic limb becomes like a set piece in a way.
I didn't even know that he has a CGI prosthetic limb in the movie.
He does. And the limb itself like saves him at a certain time. So
don't ruin it for me.
I won't. No.
All right.
But then also there was a Paralympian, whose name I don't remember at the moment, who was basically saying that, great that we're having disabled action heroes, why not have them being played by disabled performers?
Do we have a disabled performer with prosthetic legs or arms? Do we have that?
I bet we could.
In the world of actors that we... Like, do you know a name?
No, but that's not to say that there aren't any. That there aren't some.
No,
that
that's not what I'm saying.
No, I understand.
I don't know any names.
Currently, no. I mean, like, you remember in the only one I can even think of in a movie that's got any kind of prominent placement,
right?
Was the guy in Battleship? Remember? Who had the prosthetic leg?
No, I don't. I only remember Rihanna.
I knew you were going to say that.
And I only remember the pegs in the...
Yes.
The pegs light up. And right. I was like...
They're playing.
They're playing. They're actually playing Battleship right now.
I want to say Battleship. I want to say there's a character who's like recovering in a VA hospital in Hawaii or something.
Right.
Who becomes part of... Was it Battleship? I can't, it blurs to me now, but anyway, there was one character, but like very much a sort of secondary character, and they cast an actual vet with
Will casting directors cast a disabled person in a role that is not originally written for a disabled person?
Good question.
Would they do that?
Or
would they just be like, no, we don't know you, so, you know.
Well, look, obviously, when we're talking about casting directors and stuff, There's a difference between, are they going to cast the hero's best friend versus the hero? Because the hero usually is the person around whom the package is built anyway, and so, I don't know.
Want this for the future.
Yes.
I want, you know...
In the same way that we need to start cultivating trans actors in trans roles and in cis roles as well...
Yes.
We need to be cultivating, you know... disabled actors playing.
Well, they have to be out there. It's up to casting directors to cast them.
Yes.
They have to exist.
Oh, of course they're
out
there.
This is Los Angeles.
There's
everything. Everyone is here.
Yes.
I'm
not saying they don't exist. I'm saying they need to get the gigs.
Right.
Sorry. They need to get the jobs. You told me gig is out now.
Can you not put me on blast for everybody?
Well,
you can blame Vincent Lopez for telling me that.
You didn't even tell me that part. Well, then forget it.
He knows things.
I'm not listening to him.
He says gig is corny.
Ugh, well,
he says the word gig is corny. I said, okay, I believe you.
He is corny. He's the one trying to bring cute back all the time. Is it cute? Is it cute? I'm only interested if it's cute. No, thank you. Gig, 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 gig.
Okay. Listen, Vincent Lopez, I know you're probably listening. Maybe you're not. I don't know. Does he listen to us?
I have no idea. He's been on the show.
Hey, very good friend. Are you listening to this podcast?
Supposed friend of the show.
Okay. Here's one that I saw that you did not.
What's that?
McQueen.
Yes, which had a very successful opening weekend. Had like a 24,000 plus per screen average on four screens.
Well, I'll tell you why. It's very, very good.
And good movies automatically make money.
Well, I'm hoping that's why.
I see.
You know, there's a lot of fashion docs out there.
That's true, yeah. In the last decade.
The past decade, there have been a lot of documentaries about fashion. I remember when there were hardly any. Like, I remember going to the Dallas Video Festival to see the Yoji Yamamoto documentary. This is the early 90s. And I was like, ooh, a fashion documentary.
There's been like three about Yves Saint Laurent alone.
Oh, yeah. And then bang, 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 there were those ones about
the two biopics.
Yves Saint Laurent. I'm not even talking about the biopics.
No, I know. The three docs.
Documentaries though. About yeah. it. Now there's an app for your Apple TV or whatever other kind of, you know, Roku or whatever.
I think it's also a channel on YouTube if you don't. Do those things
called M2M, made to measure, that shows lots of fashion documentaries.
Yep.
And runway shows. We sat around watching runway shows last night.
And for a while they even had like some narrative features like Kiet Vu Pali Magoo.
Yeah. So this film is from directors Ian Bonholt and Peter Etedgi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably ruining his last name. This is about Alexander McQueen. Alexander McQueen died in the year 2010. He committed suicide on the eve of his mother's funeral. Mm. He was so devastated by the loss of his mother that it sort of pushed him past the... He was already... he already had a very troubled existence. He dealt with a lot of depression and anxiety. And he had begun using a lot of drugs to self-medicate. And I'm telling this backwards because all of this took place after he became rich and successful and a name. And he started his career as a name, but a name that was associated sort of with, you know, infamy, because his runway shows from the time he was a student to the mid-late 90s were scandalous. The press would often be completely uncomprehending, particularly regarding one in 1995 called the Highland Rape, which was about... there was a runway show that was about the subjugation of Scotland by England and represented by women, you know, women models in, you know, wildly constructed, often torn, different tartans, their breasts exposed, their eyes, blacked out with those contacts that obscure your entire eye. Ugh. Turn your eye black.
Yeah.
Like just a shiny black orb coming out of your eyes. And they were instructed not to do what models always do, which is walk and look expressionless. The models were instructed to act. So they came out with like agonizing scowls on their faces, agonized scowls on their faces.
Staggering.
Staggering, stumbling. They were really, it was theater. And immediately he was called misogynist and other collections also courted, you know, an outraged press. The British press is a little different from the American press. But over the years, you know, like he wound up at the house, he wound up at Givenchy. And he made the French angry, too, because they were like, who are these snotty British kids coming in? You know, these little ravers or whatever, and what are they doing? Because Givenchy is, you know...
Established.
Elegance, yes. And, you know, part of the fashion, French fashion establishment.
Audrey Hepburn!
Yeah, Audrey Hepburn, yeah. And he was a wild thing, and yeah. He came in and just... He even sort of upended... the way the house was run. Like he would go down into the workrooms, which had not been done before. He would invite the seamstresses up into his part of the building to talk to them about what was going on. Like he wanted to talk to them. You know, he would eat in the canteen that was in the building with the seamstresses.
Oh.
Which was not done.
No. Hubert never did that.
Right. He, so he just, you know, he turned everything upside down. And they hated him, but then people started to be like, oh no, this guy's awesome. Gucci came in, they bought him out, and he got his own eponymous line, and the more famous he became, the more troubled he became. It is a documentary that uses traditional documentary elements, a very traditional structure, archival footage, interviews, and even goes chronologically through his career, which those three things to me are often the kiss of boredom for a documentary. But this is so...
If the story's good enough.
Sort of meticulously arranged and well edited. It's so well done that you don't mind that Sarah Burton, who was his right-hand person, and who is now the head designer at Alexander McQueen, who worked with him for, you know, 10 years and then sort of took over when he died,
His Donatello, basically.
She did not participate in the doc. You see her in archival footage.
Right.
Katie England, his stylist, she did not participate. There's no mention of his last partner. And he couldn't participate because he died, but not long after McQueen died. They talk to old boyfriends, they talk to old friends, they talk to family members. It's so well organized and so moving and so sad. It is a really sad story. But what balances that sadness is these staggeringly beautiful runway shows that you realize as you're watching it, they are the reason that the entire film is in chronological order, because his runway shows were autobiography. From the beginning to the end, you were watching his life played out in clothing. I've never known a fashion designer who would be that personal and make those shows be kind of about his life and about, you know, other historical references and his own personal historical references. It is a film, if you can, if it plays in a theater near you and you have any interest in seeing it, please do go see it on a screen, because there is such staggering beauty in this film. I love this movie.
So it's like telling Van Gogh's story via the painting.
Kinda, yeah. And it has the most glorious moment, I believe, of his runway show's career. The Shalom Harlow spray paint dress situation. I remember watching that on VH1's Fashion File and calling you into the room. You have no memory of this. Calling you into the room, going, come here, come here, come here, come here. Look at this. He sent Shalom Harlow. She was a big deal in the 90s. She figures prominently in the extremely happy ending of the Isaac Mizrahi documentary, Unzipped. She's one of the models walking down the runway.
She also plays Matt Dillon's girlfriend in In and Out.
Yes. She's one of the models walking down the runway at the end of Unzipped, swinging this bag. And she's like, she had such personality as a model. You don't see her around modeling much anymore, at least I don't. I have no idea what she's doing now, but in the 90s, Shalom Harlow was a thing in the 90s. She comes out in this blank canvas of a dress, this white dress that's got a belt on top. And she's on a rotating turntable, and she's just slowly moving around. And the dress is very sort of like conical, so it's sort of this inverted cone where she's just sort of like, she almost looks like a spinning top, like she might fall down in this thing. And these robots with spray jets on them just spring to life and start rotating also. And then they start doing these sort of menacing, like jabby kind of movements, like, we're going to get you, Shalom Harlow, you know. And then they both take aim and blast her with spray paint. It randomly starts spray painting this dress in black and gold paint. And of course, because he instructs all of his models to participate and not just wear things, she's acting. So she has this like shock, dismay, like, oh no, I'm being attacked by the spray paint robots. But by the time it's over and she's still spinning and they're spinning and spraying paint everywhere, I swear the front row people got spray painted. The look on her face has changed to this sort of like almost sexual ecstasy. Like she's like her waving her arms in her face, and like her face is like she's rolling her head and she's so blissed out by it. Spray paint is covering part of her body as well. It's like all over her arms and her torso. It's staggering to watch. And they show you the whole thing in the doc. You can also see it on YouTube. You can see this moment on YouTube.
Yeah, I've seen it, I think, in the trailer for this
movie. M2M uses it as a clip for their promo spots, their bumpers. If you watch M2M, the app, that moment is one of their, like, here's a thing, and here's another thing, and here's another thing. Yeah. Hmm. It's been seen a lot. It's a very famous fashion moment. Yeah. Hmm. Anyway, this movie is deeply sad. And if you go, just do me a favor. When Isabella Blow comes on screen, have the class not to laugh out loud, because the jerks at my press screening, I'm not going to say what journalism organization they represented, but they did mostly represent a specific journalism organization that is in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Sorry, in Hollywood.
An association in Hollywood?
Perhaps you could call it an association.
Of the press?
Of certain press. A good three or four people laughed out loud when Isabella Blow came on screen, because she dressed up.
As she pleased.
Always. As she pleased. In the most avant-garde of things. Just to walk around every day. And she was amazing. She has since passed away as well. And that is part of the film. But have some chill, please. And don't act like you've never seen an outrageously dressed fashion person before. Because you have.
A fancy lady.
A fancy lady wearing wild hats and wild outfits every damn day of her life. Because she felt like it. Anyway. Now you know.
Very well.
Isabella Blow is going to prance on screen, and you're going to see her in all her splendor. Calm down. Oh boy, did I want to yell at the assembled journalists who laughed.
Well,
I, you
know.
I do know. I know all too well.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so, 8th grade.
Ah, yes. 8th grade.
The one y'all have been bugging us to talk about. It's from Bo Burnham.
Yes.
His debut feature.
It is.
His debut feature.
Feature. Starring the extraordinary Elsie Fisher as a young girl named Kayla?
I believe.
Who is in the last week of 8th grade. Kayla is... records YouTube videos in which she gives advice about putting yourself out there and trying new things and making friends and you know, things that Kayla does not do in her life.
Well, she does them. She just doesn't do them very well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I kept thinking of...
But her YouTube persona...
Yes.
...is of tween advice giver.
Right.
Yeah.
I kept thinking about Alice in Wonderland, the animated version, where she says, I give myself very good advice, but I very seldom follow it.
Right.
And so it's really just over the course of this week, sort of, we get a feel for what her life is like and what her relationship with her dad, is played by Josh Hamilton, is like, and the prospect of what high school is going to be like for her and what friends she might make and what changes she might experience. And, her own past and her own future. And it's part of the movie made me clench in a way that no movie has since Welcome to the Dollhouse, in terms of just what the horror of adolescence is like.
Yeah.
But it's very unlike Welcome to the Dollhouse in that it doesn't have that movie's biliousness.
All right, as long as you're talking about Welcome to the Dollhouse right now, we'll go down that road for a second. This is a more kind-hearted Welcome to the Dollhouse.
Yes.
Welcome to the Dollhouse spared no one. And it had the nerve not to spare its heroine.
Mm.
Which I believe made it a really, really strong film, and one of the best, in my opinion, films of the 1990s.
I agree.
I had never seen a film like Welcome to the Dollhouse, and I haven't yet since. Hmm. Now, granted, I've seen Todd Solondz's films since Welcome to the Dollhouse, and they all do that. They all take it as far as it can go.
Right.
That doesn't mean to me, and this is an argument that you and I have had about Todd Solondz forever, and is unresolved. That doesn't mean to me that Todd Solondz lacks empathy for his characters. I believe he has so much empathy for his characters that he's actively sort of mourning for them and grieving for them as they, you know, crash and
suffer the torments of the damned.
Suffer around him.
Right.
I don't think he's torturing his characters. I think he is mourning them. That is how his films feel to me. But he does so without sentimentality.
Sure.
And therefore, it can feel harsh. This film...
I don't think traffics in sentimentality, but it does offer some hope.
This film does not traffic in sentimentality. That is not where I was going. Okay. What I was going to say was, this film has more light.
Yes.
And more hope. And has... It's hard on its sleeve, mostly throughout the film. Like, it wants you to feel for this child. And it wants you to feel good about her well-being at the end.
Yes.
Which I do not begrudge. I think that's a fine way to end a film, with a little ray of hope. Because the way you get there is not just harrowing, but really telling about how kids are, how parents are. I think Josh Hamilton in this film as the father is so spot on as this parent who has unwittingly and without meaning to, and would be aghast at himself if he knew that this was what he was doing, transferring his own awkwardness to this child. There's no mother. He says, there's one line in the film where we hear about the mother, and he says, when mom left. Now, we don't know what that means.
Right.
We don't know where she is, why she left, what happened. If she's alive, we don't know where the mother is, but she's not in the picture. If I would fault the movie for anything, I would fault the movie for not exploring what a motherless girl goes through and what that means. You know? What a motherless child, period, goes through and what that means. Speaking as someone
it's not like there's
who lived that personally,
right?
It matters. And so if I have any complaint, it's that. Like, give me more than one sentence about the effect of an absent mother on this child. Otherwise, I think it's just spot on, observant, thoughtful. It's funny in terrible, terrible ways. And there's so much tension in a few scenes where you are desperately hoping that she comes out of the situation she's in.
Yes.
Intact.
Yes. It's one of my favorite movies of the year.
And I gotta just also say, there is a girl in this movie. This is only her third thing that she's been in. Her name is Catherine Olivieri. I don't know how you say her last name. She's the main mean girl.
Oh.
Oh my.
She's got quite the side mutter.
She is devastating in her moments.
Yeah.
Where her job in this film is to simply be... It's not even a sort of like, it's not even that dynasty kind of withering dismissal. It's, oh, do you exist?
Yeah. It's like she looks through this girl.
Yeah. The most reaction she gets from this mean girl, the mean girl's character's name is Kennedy. It's a perfect mean girl name.
Yes.
The biggest reaction to Kayla that you get from this character, Kennedy, is an eye roll. An eye roll combined with a look at the other girls.
Uh-huh.
This, we're so embarrassed to be with you right now.
Right.
If you're easily triggered by your own childhood traumas being played out on a screen, maybe wait for it to come to home video, the VHS VCR player in your house.
But you know what? It might also be kind of purgative.
It might. I bought a ticket to see it at the Arclight, and there was an entire row of middle school girls accompanied by adults. This is an R-rated movie.
Yeah, which is some BS right there.
It's an R-rated movie because of language and because of very frank sort of sexual discussions.
In a couple scenes.
In a couple scenes. But this row of 6th, 7th, 8th grade girls at this film. Not one cell phone went on during the movie. I was sitting behind them. Mm-hmm. And my first thought was, you're going to have to move. They won't be able to resist taking out their phones. Because before the film, they all had their phones.
Of course.
Absolute silence. No phones came out.
Wow.
They were
riveted.
Living it right then. Yeah. I didn't hear any conversations from them after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because I left before they did.
Right.
Arclight does this super annoying thing right now, where they do this thing called Arclight Stories.
Oh, yeah.
Where they show you basically the press junket after the movie.
Yes, yes.
And they frame it as, we have interviews with the cast and the director. I'm like, no, you have the press junket footage, which is full of, like, boring, not interesting questions.
Never.
And rote answers. And so they're like, everybody make sure to stay after the movie for the Arclight Stories. And I'm they are boring. Don't do it.
For BoJack Horseman sitting next to the Secretariat poster and answering the same question a million times.
Yeah, yeah. So they all stayed and watched, you know, the press junket after the fact. I bailed.
Right.
And there was actually someone, an employee, I don't know which employee it was, although I was like, Arclight Stories. And I was like, I have to pee.
Thanks, but no. They're always trying to get you to save for the credits. You run out of superhero movies, same deal.
Most of the time, I stay for the end, to the very end of the credits.
Right.
If it's a superhero movie with 15-minute credits and some little button at the end of, you know, something that doesn't make any sense to me that I have to ask you about anyway.
Right.
Why should I bother?
Fair enough.
Most films, though, I stay right through the end of the credits.
What else are we talking about this week? Oh, Keeper of the Run of Show.
Les Parents Terribles.
Ah, yes, which you saw and I did not.
There's a restoration of this film making its way around art houses around the country. Jean Cocteau film from 1948, I think, based on his own play. Right. What to call it? A very bleak chamber comedy.
Right.
About a extremely difficult family. Where the mother and son have a devotion to one another that is unhealthy. The son is played by Jean Marais.
Who was, of course, le boyfriend of Jean Cocteau.
For years.
Yes.
Yeah.
And most famously played La Bête.
Jean Marais was so annoyed by his reputation on screen as a pretty boy.
Mm-hmm.
That he actually was like, he made Cocteau write this kind of for him, so he could sort of stretch out a bit.
But he was so pretty.
Sure. I mean, he's a legendary French beautiful man of cinema.
He's hotter in the Beast makeup. Obviously.
The first time I saw him was Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
And the thing that always plagues productions of Beauty and the Beast, whether they are animated or real life, is the Beast is hotter than the guy playing him. Because they always hire some, like, elegantly featured, refined-looking man mm-hmm. to play the prince and then cover him up with a ton of makeup that's supposed to make him look, you know, horrifying, but in reality it just makes him look hot. And so, you know, at the end of Beauty and the Beast, when you see his face, you're like, okay, just go back to Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
Like,
somebody should do, like, a Beauty and the Beast sequel that's like Vertigo, where she makes him, like, put on the pink beast's head.
Yes, because it can't matter to you.
That's what she's attracted to.
No, it's sort of like, I also understand Alain Delon.
Yes.
Legendary French man, beautiful person.
Yes.
Okay. I feel nothing when I look at Alain Delon. I feel nothing when I look at Jean Marais. I just see the face of that man and I think, oh yes, you're one of those elegantly trim men with beautiful, finely featured faces.
Yes, you step back and you go,
I get it.
You go, okay, that is a handsome gentleman.
I get it. You're beautiful.
Like, you don't swoon over him.
Okay. You're beautiful, right? But, like, that truck driver over there with the mug?
Yeah.
That's my man.
Like, 70s Gerard Depardieu.
Kinda, yeah.
Like, early, like, going places Gerard Depardieu.
Listen, Bob Hoskins in The Long Good Friday.
That's what I'm
talking about.
That's your baseline.
I understand. You know, you get me. Listeners know what I'm about. Sorry. Sorry, beautiful people. You don't really interest me.
You have your place in this world.
Yes, and it's a place that is full of treats for you.
A golden tuffet.
So, yeah.
So who else is in this?
Well, Gabrielle Dorziat, legendary French actress. She lived to be 99 years old. She acted from The Silence mm-hmm. to the late 60s.
I think Danielle Darrieux made it past 100.
Did she?
Yeah.
Also, Yvonne Debray as the mother.
Mm.
And, interestingly enough, Josette Day as the girlfriend. And she, of course, was in. So these were the two films that they were in together.
Yeah.
So the story is, this family all lives kind of on top of each other. This bourgeoisie kind of family.
Right.
They don't have much money, but they have aspirations above their station. And the mother and the son are way too close. So much so that when the mother wakes up one morning and the son hasn't come home at night, she's in hysterics. Because what that means is that he has met a woman. And has spent the night with her. There was no production code, by the way, in France.
Oh, no.
Like there was in the United States. So you could talk about anything.
Oh, but you know what there was in the United States?
Yeah.
Vague subtitling.
Well, yeah.
Because I've seen, like, old prints of, like, Bergman's Smiles of a Summer Night.
Right.
And it's like, there's a lot of conversation going on here that is not being subtitled. Then I saw it again later, like, oh, that's what they were talking about.
Right. So it turns out he does have the son, Jean Marais, does have a girlfriend. It's Josette Day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dad, who's sort of checked out from the marriage, he's got a girlfriend too. Also Josette Day.
Dun, dun, dun.
So father and son are doing it with the same woman, mm-hmm. only no one knows about it. No one knows.
Her included.
She included. She doesn't know that they are father and son, and the father and son do not know that they are with the same woman. Things go wrong after that. In a way that is comedic and then tragic.
Right.
What a great movie this is. And what a weird, bleak story about failure and about how relationships turn sour or become screwed up.
Now, I've seen this on stage. Does the movie feel stage bound or not?
Well, it opens in a very Baz Luhrmann-y sort of way with a rising curtain.
Huh.
And it closes with the camera pulling out of this sort of tableau that they're all in.
Hmm.
So it is very much a confined space film. It takes place in two apartments,
right,
in about five different rooms. So yeah, you're stuck with them the whole time, and you really begin to feel it. It's great. If you get a chance, if it comes to your town, go.
I wish I could have seen it, because I saw the Broadway revival, which they performed under the title Indiscretions.
Yeah.
But the parents were Roger Reese and Kathleen Turner.
Mm-hmm.
The son was Jude Law, I think his Broadway debut. This was like 1993.
Yeah.
And the girl was Cynthia Nixon.
Mm.
And that production was infamous because there's a scene where Jude Law stands up in the bathtub, en déshabillé, as the French like to say.
Undraped on the stage.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's wonderful. Go.
I missed it because of Alphys. I was going to talk about Alphys a little, but not if we have more. Is there more stuff we haven't got?
Let me look at my list here. Sorry to Bother You opens wide, or did open wide.
Yes.
Please go.
And we'll
don't sleep on Tessa Thompson in this movie, because she doesn't have a lot to do, but what she does, she makes great use of. Like, I forgot to talk about that when we talked about Sorry to Bother You.
Well, we're going to talk about Blind Spotting next time, which you're going to catch up on. And it will be inevitable that we talk more about Sorry to Bother You when we talk about Blind Spotting. Outfits went really well and had... I was really pleased with a lot of the feedback I was getting, and the houses were really good. And, I mean, there was a lot of trans content. There was a lot of episodic content, including there was a panel with the people behind Vita on Stars.
I love that show.
Vita
is such a good show.
Yeah, I wish you could have gone to this. I'm trying to think with like some of the standouts. Yen Tan's film 1985, devastating.
Yeah.
People really loved that. It's going to be opening in the fall. I got to do a Q&A with Virginia Madsen.
Right.
Which was awesome. I also got to do a Q&A with Rita Moreno. After the
I would like you to tell that story, please. Please tell the Rita Moreno story right now, because it just made me really happy to hear it.
This was after the Terrence McNally documentary called Every Act of Life, which is coming out this fall, and it's great, and you should see it. But so we had her on stage, and she was great. And just, it was the kind of thing where, like, you know, Justin Kirk, you know, the actor who had gotten his start in Love, Valor, Compassion on Broadway, the director was there, his wife was a producer was there, this other producer there. But Rita Moreno clearly was just, like, gonna be in charge. From the moment she sat down on stage, it was like, I got this. So she's, like, kind of, you know, telling these different things and blah, blah, blah. And at one point, there's a pause, and she goes, oh, can I tell a story about a thing that was happening when we were working on the Ritz? And I looked at her, and I looked at the audience, and I said, no? Of course you can.
Right.
And she looked at me, she goes, well, I was going to tell it anyway. And then launches into this anecdote. And then afterwards, I was shaking hands with her, and I said, I have to tell you, I was an Electric Company kid. And she goes, oh, did I teach you to read? And I said, well, a little bit. But mainly, you were the first person I ever saw on television speaking Spanish. You know, and I my parents are both from Spain. I grew up, you know, in a household where we spoke Spanish, but to hear you speak Spanish on television like that, you know, the thing I always remember.
Yep.
And she goes, oh, you're Spanish. And so then, you know, the film people all get together and they're taking these pictures on stage. And the director at one point comes like, oh, please hop in. And and she goes, yes, Alonso. So that was my Rita Moreno moment.
That's my favorite Outfest story from you. Better than an Arclight story.
There you go. Definitely a movie to keep an eye out for is a Chilean film that we world premiered called Cola de Mono, which I've been describing it as Stranger Things for gay men whose sexuality was shaped by cruising and the fan.
Yes.
And weirdly enough, it... And
so it's for me.
Yes.
Okay.
The Gola de Mono and 1985 and H.P. Mendoza's new movie Bitter Melon are all set at Christmas. So I've always complained there aren't enough gay Christmas movies.
Excellent.
We're getting some. And there's a documentary called Dykes Camera Action that's terrific. And as I mentioned before, friend of the show, Drew Droege, won our Best Actor Award for his one-man piece.
That's lovely.
Bright Colors and Bold Patterns, which you can now get on Broadway HD if you have been wanting to subscribe, or if they have like a seven-day trial period or whatever and you want to see some stuff. Definitely check out Bright Colors and Bold Patterns. It's really great.
What's your DVD pick this week?
It's actually another thing that I saw at Outfest. There's a 1985 film called Buddies, and I'd always heard of it, but I'd never seen it.
Right.
It was not easily available, and I know, you know, our friend Jenny Olson, who's an archivist, had been kind of chasing it down for a while, and it was, I guess it was maybe in the New Line catalog, but nobody was paying attention to it, or because New Line released it back in 85, but this is sort of pre-Freddy Krueger New Line, when they were a much smaller indie. They weren't what they became later.
Right.
It was the first theatrical feature about AIDS. And in fact, they were saying that 4 days after the film premiered at Frameline in San Francisco was when Ronald Reagan actually said the word AIDS in public for the first time.
Right.
So that's how early on this thing was made. And it's this just lovely story about, you know, there's this kind of yuppie-ish gay guy who volunteers to be an AIDS buddy, and he gets assigned to this guy who is sick and who is more of an activist type, and how they sort of, like, you know, their differing perspectives of the world change each other. And it's directed by Arthur J. Bresson Jr., who's had this really, a really fascinating career that spanned everything from documentaries to gay porn. And this movie, you know, he luckily managed to finish before he died. It's a fascinating time capsule, but it's a really substantial drama. And I started crying during the opening credits, because it's just this dot matrix printer printing out line after line of people's names with, you know, deceased AIDS. And it just keeps printing and keeps printing and keeps printing. And it just kind of reminds you of how many people went in that era, and how quickly, and how it was so kind of devastating and hopeless. But the movie is really empowering, and I think really kind of is a call to arms for like complacent gays to get political and to get active. And this was before ACT UP existed.
Right. Think about this. How many gay men do you know personally in their 60s?
Not nearly enough.
I mean, a handful?
Yeah.
A handful in our social circle.
Yeah.
Shouldn't there be more than a handful?
There
should be way more than a handful.
And I've mentioned this before. I don't bring this up with all of them, but there are times when the ones that I do have this conversation with, you know, I'll ask, like, so did you go through that thing where pretty much just everybody you knew died? And they'll say, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. And so, that there's an entire generation that just is gone. And so the ones who are left are survivors, and they are indefatigable, but they have survived a war, a genocide. I mean, like, I don't even know what the word is here.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like you're surrounded by a bunch of people who are your peers and your friends and your lovers and whatever.
I would call the lack of attention governmental organizations that could have done something more quickly, akin to genocide. The Reagan administration did nothing. They didn't pay attention. Mm-hmm. They laughed about it. And if you think that's not true, go listen to the tapes because they're on the internet.
The press conferences.
Press conferences where people laughed about it.
Yeah.
And so, that was what it was like.
And, you know, I think it's a lesson we have to keep relearning, because, in an ideal situation, politics are boring and politics are messy and politics are not fun, and who needs it? But unfortunately, if you are being actively targeted, then you need politics in your life. And right now, so many of us are being targeted, and we need politics in our lives. So yeah, sorry to be a bummer, but buddies, new 2K restoration out on Blu-ray from Vinegar Syndrome. You should see it. What about you?
Did I make this movie Shoes a DVD pick 1 week?
I don't already. Know.
Because I think I might have. Like, I have this vague memory of doing that. But I hadn't. I pushed it as a DVD pick, but I hadn't watched it yet. And I was saying, like, I'm going to watch it. And then I didn't get around to it.
We are almost 8 years in. We never made a spreadsheet of what our DVD picks were. So if you repeat it.
Okay, well, then I might be repeating this, but you can forgive me for that.
Yes.
New-ish, then, on Blu-ray. It's been out for a while. It's been out for a few months on Blu-ray, at least. A film called Shoes by Lois Weber.
What year is it from, Dave?
1916. Lois Weber was, I am learning, one of the most fascinating filmmakers. She was a child piano prodigy. She was a street corner evangelist for a while. And then she became a filmmaker, director. And women filmmakers in early film, they got to do their thing.
And there were a lot of them.
So this film has been pieced together from existing prints that were incomplete, and then they found a script, and then they organized the segments of the prints they found, and some of them were tinted prints. So, like, the film will be tinted yellow in some parts and blue in other parts. Like, I don't know the meaning of tinted silent films from that time.
In terms of?
Like, deliberately tinted. And for what reasons?
I don't know if it was just to give people something to look at that wasn't black and white. I mean, sometimes, obviously, it was done deliberately with specific intentions, whether it was like for nighttime scenes or to convey a character's state of mind, or the famous triptych at the end of Napoleon where it's red, white, and blue.
Right.
It depends.
Anyway, so this film stars 16-year-old Mary McLaren, who had a big career in silent film and then worked through the sound era for a while, but not in big starring roles. Like, I think she just kept going, even though they were like, well, yeah, but you can't talk. No one wants to hear you speak.
What's that line from Will Success for a Rock Hunter? She couldn't speak English, being from Texas.
It's an hour long. It's about 60 minutes. It is about a young girl who lives with her family, and they are desperately poor. The only source of income they have is her job at a 5 and 10. She earns $5 per week. And so this family of six, in 1916, they have to live on $5 a week. Her father is a drunk who doesn't work. Her mother tends to the three other kids, and she's the one who goes out and works. But her shoes are falling apart. She's had them resold, but now they're falling apart for the final time. And there's no money for shoes. Every dime has to go in to pay the grocery bill or the rent. So she cuts out pieces of cardboard to stick in her shoes so that she's not stepping through the holes in the soles. But then it rains. And then it rains, and then it rains, and rains. And the shoes get destroyed. Meanwhile, there's a guy who hangs around the 5 and 10, seducing young ladies with the promise of
shoes.
Help. The promise of help.
Right.
And so, you know, one of them, one of the women in the store, is like constantly elbowing
Mary.
our young heroine. Be like, go with him. Go with this guy. And she's like, no. So then things happen. It is emotionally devastating because Mary McLaren, you know why she was a star, because she was serving face in this movie.
They had faces then.
Oh my goodness, what a face. It is so heartbreaking and so moving. And this film, there are, you know, formal elements that you see them happening, camera shots and angles and things like that. And you think to yourself, is this the first time that was done? It probably was. It's at least the one that got salvaged,
right?
You know, after all this time.
Griffith didn't invent everything.
Right. And so it's exciting to watch, wondering, were you the one that thought this up? Did you think up this particular thing on your, like, were you the inventor of this particular angle or something? Right. Some of it is shot on location in 1916 Los Angeles. So, ooh, like, the Woolworth store down on Broadway or Main Street. Yeah.
Broadway, I think, yeah.
Pershing Square.
Yeah.
And so that's cool about it. The reason I'm talking about it now is because Brooklyn Academy of Music is doing a week-long showcase of early female directors. Lois Weber, Alice Guy Blaché, others. That's a week-long thing happening at Brooklyn Academy of Music, Cinematheque. And I think it's happening right now.
There's also a thing happening at Lincoln Center about female cinematographers.
Oh, okay.
It's either right now or within the next few weeks.
If you live in Los Angeles, the American Cinematheque is going to show another Lois Weber film called Where Are My Children? Which I can't seem to find on DVD or Blu-ray. TCM showed it, and we got it in TiVo and sat on it. So this weekend, I watched Shoes, and I watched Where Are My Children? Where Are My Children is about abortion.
Yeah.
And it's about women choosing to remain childless and the consequences of that. Now, American Cinematheque here is going to show Where Are My Children this coming weekend. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to show an evening of Alice Guy Blaché films. Then in November, there's going to be a box set that gets released. So I'm curious how that's going to, like, what kind of restorations are taking place? Because even though I watched a Blu-ray of Shoes, there are patches of this film that even in Blu-ray are almost entirely degraded.
Well, that's the challenge with films that air. I mean, like, remember you and I saw that we saw kind of a work in progress restoration of Different from the Others.
Different from the Others, yes.
And that's a movie that was knocking around in various sort of VHS and DVD versions for a while.
Yeah.
But Outfest really kind of went in and did the legwork and found the screenplay, figured out what was missing, cobbled together, you know, the prints had been destroyed by the Nazis, but some of the footage had been used in other movies and stuff, and they were kind of put together these sort of intertitles to sort of to bridge what happened between this scene and that scene. Very often you might see a silent film, but then a few years later, somebody will come out with a more complete version of that silent film. You know, like, I mean, how many versions of Metropolis have we seen over the course of our adult lives, you know? Yeah.
So I don't know what the restorations are going to look like on the box set, and I don't know what they look like in screenings that are taking place this week and also this weekend in New York and Los Angeles. But if you live there and you can go, you should go, because, oh my God, Where Are My Children is something else.
Yeah. No matter where you stand on the issue, it's just like, woo.
Yeah. So that's it. That's what I was going to say. You can get Shoes on Blu-ray from Milestone.
Yes.
I'm holding it here in my hand. You can also get another Lois Weber film on Blu-ray called The Dumb Girl of Portici.
Yes.
Again, from 1916. 102 years ago, when the word dumb meant mute. Yes. So that was the name of the film.
Right.
Anyway.
So we're super long, so we'll hold letters for next time. We're gonna do some letter catching up, I promise. I know I always say we're gonna do it, but it will happen, I assure you. Hey, we have a Patreon. Patreon.com/linoleumknife. We offer extra content like LKTV, a podcast of the television, and Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics, and Linoleum Nights, the one where we talk about sex and politics and religion and swear, because you kind of have to. And there's also neat prizes like t-shirts and Christmas ornaments and magnets, and there's enamel pins and Google Hangouts and club meetings and all kinds of stuff. So go to patreon.com/linoleumknife and check that out. Go visit the people I always tell you to visit. We're running late. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. You can please give us a 5-star rating when you subscribe to the show over at Apple Podcasts. It helps people find the show. And, you know, really, any podcast that you like and want to support, whether you can give them money or not, leave them a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts. It makes a major difference. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Spotify, Google Play, CastBox, Podbean, etc., etc. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com. And anything else?
No.
All right. Well, until next time.
Goodbye.